This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at the University of Chicago and NYU. And we turn to Supreme Court history. It is called the Judicial Procedures Reform Bill of 1937, remembered in history as court packing. This is during the second term of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who won an overwhelming victory in the 1936 presidential election against Alf Landon of Kansas. However, that victory, in an era with rudimentary polling, apparently misled the supporters of FDR and the New Deal. There had been several disappointments in the first term having to do with the ambition of the administration to correct the now-called Great Depression. At the time, it was spreading worldwide, and there was alarm all around the world. We know of the catastrophes that were ahead of us in the 1940s. In the time, FDR and his New Dealers believed that the court was standing in their way, led by a man named Charles Evans Hughes, former Supreme Court Associate Justice, former governor of New York, former presidential candidate. He lost in 1916 to Woodrow Wilson. And now the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. FDR's complaint was that the court was not catching up with all the work that was before it, and it needed help. It was called court packing. He wanted to grow the court so that, it was said, they could handle all the details. Charles Evans Hughes pushed back on that, saying, "We're doing fine." However, it came to public opinion, and also public opinion expressed in the dominant Democratic House and Senate. Dominant, overwhelming numbers. This is the New Deal. Richard, a very good evening to you.
Yes.
FDR was not able to persuade the public. And in fact, after the setback of 1937, I believe his advisors said that you misread 1936, and his popularity dipped a little during 1937 into 1938. Here we are in the 21st century. Has Joe Biden learned from the events of 1937? Do you see that evidence in the Biden administration? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Look, I think in effect he did learn something, because what happened is Roosevelt pushed this thing without trying to get some kind of legitimate backing from respectable bodies, commissions, and so forth. It turned out he had no support for him whatsoever. Charles Evans Hughes wrote this very diplomatic letter saying, you know, the internal dynamics of the court are very fragile, and if you start to push something like this, you could change everything in ways that will make things for the worst. So that was a kind of a death blow, because Hughes was regarded at the time as an impeccable figure given his past and history. Biden put together a commission, and he staffed it with the top with two people whom I would say would be centrist Democrats, Christina Rodriguez and Bob Bauer. And he put together a commission which was decidedly on the left in terms of what happened, but it was much left center as it was far left, with relatively few strong progressives. So they sit down and they start getting inputs. And what's absolutely amazing about what the inputs were is there was relatively little support for court packing and a lot of support for other kinds of reforms, most notably term limits for Supreme Court justices and a reform of the process. The report comes out. It is not something that could be called anything like an endorsement of the court packing bill. Indeed, it was probably coming out pretty clearly the opposite way, taking the wind out of the sail. How do you know that that's the kind of position that Well, you look at who defended the report and who denounced the report. And it was people on the hard left who come out there and say, this is an outrageous, an abnegation. We're not going to address the major problems. We're still going to have a 6-3 conservative majority. This is going to be woe unto everybody, and we have to change it. But then after that, the whole thing kind of disappeared like a stone. Nobody seems to be talking about it a week or 10 days after what had happened. That's because I think the consensus was formed. And you look at who was in this assembly. Center for American Progress, the Civil Liberties Union. There was a very powerful letter written by 20 or so prominent Supreme Court advocates headed by Maureen Mahoney and by Ken Geller, and it was unanimous against the court packing type situation. So there is no institutional support, and I think what happens is Biden, knowing that he has his hands full on 1,000 other agenda items, and he's going to have to retreat pretty much on all of those as well, I suspect, decided, I think, just to let the thing sit. So,
Richard, I want to introduce, however, one of the drivers for this was a political consideration by Mr. McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate. In the late stages of the Trump administration, when the polls were showing that Mr. Trump might not be successful in re-election, there was an opportunity to correct all of this by to add to the court, and therefore the decision was made to expedite the nomination and confirmation of Associate Justice Barrett, now on the court. Reflecting back about the events late in Barack Obama's term, this is 2016, when Mr. Obama was term limited, and so therefore there was going to be a new president soon enough, the decision was made by the same Mr. McConnell not to allow to go forward the nomination of Merrick Garland by President Obama. That is, more than any other, the instance that was presented for why the court is distorted by political means. And I believe this committee was to answer some of that complaint.
Well, it turns out they did address that issue, and it was a remarkably anodyne statement. They didn't say much about everything. Let's just go back and remember what the lay of the land. When McConnell said that we're not going to consider this nomination, what he did is he had a majority of the votes. In some sense, if you gave him a hearing and then you spent your time, you know, smearing his name and denouncing him for all sorts of terrible things and then voting against him, I think it would have been worse than what he did do, which is simply say, we're not going to consider this nomination. We don't have to. In fact, the practice of not considering nominations goes back much earlier to the Bush administration with people like Miguel Estrada. Never got a hearing whatsoever by anybody, and there was nobody on the Democratic side when they were in control who thought that they did anything wrong. This is not a case in which you could say what they did was something illegal or improper given Senate procedures. The question about advice and consent from the Senate is something which is determined by internal rules. All the votes are free, and if you decide not to have a vote under the internal rules, that's true. Then when it comes out that you have Trump in the office and the Republicans still control the Senate, now in effect, what happens is you've got no opposition, and the Republicans are going to push for their advantage. I think the biggest mistake that they made was trying to be so pious and to announce that there was some deep neutral principle that supported them when they said, oh, we have to go for an election back in 2016, and then in 2020 said, we're going to use everything we have, and we don't have to go for an election at all. I think it's stupid to do that. I think the correct way to deal with this is to be very candid. These appointments are extremely important, more important, I think, by far than, say, the appointment of a Secretary of State or something like that. Why is that? Because they last for 20 or 30 years, and secretaries come and go with administrations, and it's much shorter. So what happens is everybody, and I think rightly, says, when I think about a Supreme Court judgment and a judge, I'm thinking about the long term. I don't give any reference to the president because this appointment is going to outlast this term, and it's going to be an independent judge. If you want to have a Secretary of State, I'd be very loath to tell a president, here's somebody who's respectable, but I don't want you to have it, and then immediately hamstring the administration in the short run. So what's happened is the politics has now diverged in these two areas. The political appointees usually get a lot of deference and are quickly done. The Supreme Court nominees, it's straight long-term power politics, and everybody understands it on both sides. And so if you actually read the report of the commission, it's kind of like a clinical dissection. Well, the one side said this, and the other side said that. you know, use my little word finder and so forth, and you could not see the words theft or stealing or something like that in the report.
Oh, let me read Senator Sheldon Whitehouse's remark after reading
the report. Oh, he's a great guy there.
This report is a disappointment to anyone who'd hoped for a hard-hitting effort to address the Supreme Court's deep troubles. What deep troubles, Richard? What they wanted 7-6. How would that have helped them to have a court of 13?
Well, it turns out it's 7-6, at least in the very short run. Then the politics start to change and everything disintegrates. All he wanted to do was a complete result-oriented situation. Even if he got four nominees, it's not at all clear that they would all be on the same side of these same issues. It's kind of bizarre that you're willing to wreck the structure. Something which has been basically constant since 1869 in order to achieve an advantage which will last into 2025. And I think everybody understands that the long-term game is much more important institutionally. And if it turns out you don't have to decide this 13 question in favor of expansion for this particular game, you won't do it. Everybody else says, oh my God, a White House wants all this stuff. That's the last thing that I want to have happen is to have that guy dictate the policy. Remember, this is the guy who tried to intimidate the Supreme Court on issues like gun control and so forth. They say, we're watching after you. We're looking after you. He's the worst person to try to make this into a high-minded, noble adventure, since he's the most rabid partisan that you see out there anywhere on either side of the particular issue. So my view about this is once you get him coming out and with the denunciation.
We're talking about Senator Whitehouse, yes?
Yes. Once you see an ironic name, I might add, once you see Senator Whitehouse coming out denouncing it, that means that everybody else knows it's safe to support the commission on this because this guy is now a complete outlier. And there was nobody, but nobody who did anything in the reporting who did this. It was really quite a remarkable situation that when the commission was put together and asked to talk about long-term structural reform, they had a pretty clear, very detailed history of everything that went on. And there's a reason why you give history if you want to write a report like this. What it does is it sort of stabilizes and fixes the parameters of permissible changes. You've got all this past. You have an accumulated practice. There are many people on the commission who actually think that constitutional practice really matters. And so you can't be a rebel if it turns out that what you do is you stress the history.
All right,
the only way to be a rebel is to be acontextual.
Let's turn to what is to be done, because there are still doubts about the credibility of the Supreme Court. What can strengthen it when we come back? Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution, writing for Defining Ideas. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.